Our next guest writes that we are living in a second simultaneous pandemic, one of addiction. And while there isn't a singular cure, we do have agency. We can prevent substance abuse in adults if we better understand how to reduce the risk factors in kids. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How big of a problem do you see addiction in your life, in your family? How does it rank among the other things you see as major problems we're facing as a society? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Ask your question. Help us understand your story. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Jessica Leahy is a teacher, a writer, and a mom. She writes about education, parenting, and child welfare for a variety of news outlets. Her latest book out today is called The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. Jess, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
You offer a disclaimer with this. You're not a medical professional. The things we're going to talk about, though, very, very thoroughly researched and like lived personally. Help us understand kind of the background work you did for this book.
Sure. So I actually, I'm an alcoholic myself. I have almost 8 years of recovery. I worked for 5 years teaching in an inpatient drug and alcohol rehab for kids. I'm a mom. I have two kids of my own. And my what I really wanted was a resource that really explained on a very micro level what the phrase substance abuse is preventable, what that means, what preventable means. And I have, from, you know, in my opinion, the best job in the whole world. I go looking for a book that I need. And if it doesn't exist, I write it. So I spent a couple of years researching this book a year before I even wrote the proposal for this book. And essentially, it breaks down what we can control, what we can't, what the real risk factors are, and what the sort of evidence-based protections are.
Yeah, because you go into a variety of detail throughout it. You know, it can get really complicated. And yet toward the beginning, you really just break down some things, what different things mean, different kinds of drugs, what they do, and how addiction works. How critical do you think it is to provide that information that I think we all just kind of assume everybody knows about, but maybe we don't understand fully?
Well, I think a lot is known about substance abuse and addiction in adults. Well, that's not what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. The bulk of the book really is about the adolescent brain, what's happening in the adolescent brain, why the messaging that we give them is really important and how we present it is important, what we are and are not doing. We could be doing so much more evidence-based stuff to help prevent substance abuse in kids. And like I said, the adolescent brain is going through an incredibly profound, delicate process of growing, becoming, you know, synapses are growing and myelination is happening and all these things. It's a really delicate balance. And so things that in an adult brain, you know, might have a few negative effects don't really have a massive effect on us, on an adolescent brain. It's a lot more vulnerable to the environment, to the substances that we put in our bodies and our brains. And so when that door closes, that brain development door closes in the early to mid 20s, you can't go back. The things that don't get to develop during that period, that's kind of it. So we have to be really careful about protecting the adolescent brain as it's developing. And that includes substances.
You help people understand the plasticity of that adolescent brain by using an example of a guitar lesson.
Oh, it's humiliating. It's just such a humiliating example. You know, people talk about this in terms of skiing, too. If you've ever, you know, gone skiing for the first time with a kid, you know, by the end of the day, they're just zipping down the mountain and you're barely, you know, making the pizza and making your first turns. And I took guitar with my my older son, who's now in college. And, you know, by the end of the first lesson, he really had things down and I'm just working on like one chord. And it was a very short period of time before he's cranking out, you know, like Clapton's Layla. And I really had a lot of trouble just getting to the point where I could maybe strum the chords for like a really easy three chord Fleetwood Mac song. It was not the same experience for me as it was for him. And it really comes down to how quickly connections happen in the adolescent brain and how much potential there is for neurological growth in their brains. And, you know, unfortunately for some of us, our brains are a little slower to make those connections.
Yeah. So connect that to us for us then from, you know, the immense ability to learn and grow to addiction mm-hmm. and as people start experimenting.
So there's a couple things. There's a lot of things going on. First of all, in the adolescent brain, as kids grow, they're starting to connect to the upper levels of the brain, the parts of the brain that let us do the adulting stuff, the organization, the time management. That's all frontal lobe, prefrontal cortex stuff. And the, broadly labeled executive function skills happen there. And in a kid's brain, it's there, but it's just not hooked up yet fully. So all of that's happening. Lots of synapses are connecting and synapses need to talk to each other in order to continue to grow. Unless that communication continues to happen, they will die off. When we also do this thing called myelination in the brain, where we have this fatty sheath that gets laid down over the neurons, and all of that process goes towards essentially hooking things up, making lots of pathways for communication, and then later on in adolescence, pruning back those connections so that we have the most efficient ones possible. The other thing that's happening is that there are neurotransmitters and hormones going on in the brain. The brain is awash in them, and the brain is trying so hard to keep sort of these normal levels and create like a normalcy. And, drugs and alcohol get put in the mix and it really throws that off. And finally, in the adolescent brain, dopamine is at a lower level. They have a lower baseline level of this thing called dopamine that essentially is drive. It is the thing that makes us get out of bed in the morning and want to do work and want to do the things we love. And they have lower levels of it than either children or adults. And so when our teenagers tell us that they're bored, they're not just being dramatic. They often really are, because of this lower level of dopamine. And the problem is that drugs really hijack a bunch of those things. They, we have natural, for example, opioids, and we have natural, sort of a natural THC, the ingredient in cannabis and marijuana in our brain, but we can never, ever produce the amounts that, a drug can. It really fills up those receptors. And so for kids who are craving risk and newness and excitement, you can put a lot of those, you can fulfill a lot of those needs with drugs really, really quickly, more so than you can with natural experiences. So there's a lot of things that we need to realize that we're hijacking, that we're creating a situation where the nerves can't talk to each other quite the same way. And, there are research that show that, for example, the hippocampus in a kid who uses marijuana chronically is smaller than the hippocampus in a kid who doesn't. And the hippocampus is where we do a lot of our processing memories, especially emotional memories. So there's so many ways that drugs mess with the balance that needs to happen and the growth that needs to happen in an adolescent brain.
We're talking with Jessica Leahy, who writes about parenting and education and child welfare, and her new book is called The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been thinking about some of the risk factors that our guest has mentioned, thinking about your kids or your grandkids or just people you know? What was your experience like growing up and thinking about addiction? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Jess, the title of your book includes the word inoculation. Mm-hmm. We're usually hearing that with the coronavirus right now.
Right.
And we think about it in that way as like a single or maybe a double dose of something. And then mm-hmm. that dramatically lowers our risk. But your book really focuses on like sustained practices in parenting that can help support kids as they grow up.
That word actually comes from something called inoculation theory, which is the theory that when we give the kids the tools to refute arguments that people could make for why they should do, for example, risky things, like whether that's, use substances or have sex before they're ready, that when we give them the tools they need in order to say, no, I don't think that's a good idea for me right now. Or a common example is, when a kid says to an eighth grader, for example, and by the way, middle school is the place where most kids start to experiment. So if we're waiting till middle school because we think that, oh, our kids are too young to have to worry about that stuff, then we need to back up, because we really do need to start talking about this stuff before middle school. But if a middle school kid is offered some alcohol and, you know, the kid doesn't want it, but the other kid says back to him, oh, you know, come on, everybody's doing it. If our child is armed with the information that, for example, well, no, and everyone's not doing it, by the end of eighth grade, only 24% of kids report that they try alcohol, that not only do we give them, we empower them with information and we increase their feelings of self-efficacy and confidence that they are going to be able to say no to something they don't want to do. We also increase the chances that they will use that rebuttal in order to say no to something like having a sip of alcohol. And then the other thing that's really interesting about addiction inoculation theory is it generalizes. So when we give kids ways to rebut or to refute assertions about why they should do things that they don't want to do, we actually inoculate them not just against the risky behaviors that we're aiming for, but a lot of other ones as well. So for example, if we're inoculating our kid against, you know, having alcohol before when they're young, then we're also inoculating them against, you know, for example, having sex before they're ready. These things actually generalize. And the coolest part of it is, finally, that inoculation theory works really well because it also increases communication and makes it more likely that kids will talk to their parents about the refusals and the offers that they are experiencing in their life. So that's where that word comes from. It really is a theory that clicked into place for me when I was doing the research for this book.
Jess Leahy writes about education and parenting, and we're talking about her latest book that's out today that is about raising kids in a culture of dependence. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have a short story that you want to share about how addiction or prevention has affected you or your family, someone you're close to? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. We continue this conversation ahead. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with Jess Leahy, who wrote the book, The Gift of Failure. Now she's out with another one called The Addiction Inoculation. It's about how to raise kids in a society where addiction is rampant. And we've got Ellen from Brookfield ready to talk with us. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I have a nephew who's 27 years old, a heroin addict, started with alcohol and other drugs when he was 12 years old. Well, alcohol, younger, actually. And he was also a sugar hound, and to the extent that he would have to steal and hide the candy, you know, when he's at grandma and grandpa's, and, you know, go in a room and hide and eat that. And every recovering alcoholic I know, or drug addict, is a sugar hound. And I know a few of them. Is there something that could maybe foretell a little bit in somebody's obsession with sugar?
Ellen, thanks for that question. And Jess, I know Ellen asked that question, but really this is about these addictive tendencies that show up much, much before the time that I think we assume kids get into alcohol or drugs. She's giving us the example of sugar.
Mm-hmm. I personally have never read anything about sugar specifically. One interesting side note is that people who are coming off of alcohol report really intense cravings for sugar because alcohol is a sugar. And so there's suddenly when you stop drinking, there's this just your body is saying, oh my gosh, where's all the sugar we've been used to? So there's that flip side of this. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, one of the risk factors for substance abuse is genetics. It really is, depending on your situation, you know, 50 to 60% of the risk picture. And genetics isn't just about, you know, there isn't a gene for alcoholism or a gene for addiction. There are multiple genes that are tied to your proclivity for substance abuse, how your brain reacts to various chemicals, as well as your personality. And, you know, there are generalizations that can be made about people who, you know, are really excited, need thrills, need to be on roller coasters all the time, or jumping off of, you know, their garage into the pool. And that's just that they need more stimulation in order to feel alive. And it's conceivable, although again, I have not read studies on sugar and addictive tendencies. there are people that, and I actually just did an interview with Rich Roll, who has a fantastic podcast, the Rich Roll podcast. And he jokes about the fact that, you know, he was a drug and alcohol addict and had a substance abuse, obviously. And he, you know, sort of traded that out for just being an intense endurance athlete. That's, you know, his obsession is now, you know, intense athleticism, and he throws himself wholeheartedly into everything. And another example is Penn Jillette, the magician, the half of the Penn and Teller duo. And Penn decided very early on in his life not to ever have drugs or alcohol, because he knew that he was the sort of person who was an all or nothing guy. And he did not foresee anything good for him in drugs and alcohol, because he knew that once he was in on something, he was in 100%, and he had trouble stopping. So there are certain personality traits that, for better or for worse, that can really point to the idea that you're not very good at having moderation. So that's the best possible answer I can come to, simply because I haven't read anything very specific on sugar and proclivity for substance abuse.
Well, you write and speak extensively about the hereditary connections here. You also set out in your book very clear explanations and concrete steps for parents dealing with kids in high school, in middle school. Mm-hmm. Those make sense. And then you have sections on elementary school and even preschool. Why do you set that out? And do you think people realize that we need to be doing work then?
Well, and I want to make this really clear. It's not as if we're talking to, you know, kids in preschool and kindergarten about, you know, injection drug use. We're talking right. about the places we need to start with things like, you know, general health and the things that we put into our body. And so, you know, for a nursery school or kindergarten, you're going to talk about things like, you know, why do you think we spit out the toothpaste and don't swallow it? Why do we not eat, for example, you know, Tide Pods, even though they're pretty and they look like candy? Let's look at this. There's a medicine bottle here on the counter that with my prescription in it, and see how it has the letters of my name on it. Do you think, even if you needed the same medication, do you think that maybe you could take the same medication out of this bottle? Why do you think not? What are the reasons that we don't take drugs that are prescribed for other people? Those sort of conversations are really important to start young, because it's about understanding that the things we put in our body are things that we put in our body to keep us healthy and safe. And it leads really naturally into a discussion later on of, you know, why we definitely don't take things out of the medicine cabinet that have other people's names on them. You know, most parents seem to understand that kids tend to get their first, if kids are going to try mess around with opiates, that they tend to get their first prescription opiates out of theirs or someone else's medicine cabinet. And yet only 10% of parents ever talk to their kids about the dangers of taking prescription opiates. So it's really important. So many people talk about these conversations, like the sex conversations, as being really challenging, so hard and so fraught with emotion because of the fear and because of maybe guilt over our own practices. That was certainly true for me. But when we start really, really young with conversations around prescription drugs and what's healthy for us, and maybe move into a conversation of, you know, why Uncle Ted has to stand out on the front porch at Grandma's house at Thanksgiving in order to smoke his cigarettes, why he's not allowed to smoke them in the house, these things sort of move up with us developmentally. And I think it's important to point out that in houses that where someone does have a substance abuse issue, kids as young as 3 recognize the difference between alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages and can discern between the two. So having, we tend to not give kids enough credit for understanding what it is that's happening around them and what they're seeing and experiencing. So it's going to be really important to address those things young, so that we can keep the conversation, you know, light and casual, and help them understand from a very early age that, you know, our bodies are changing and growing, and we have to protect that. And these are some of the ways that we do it.
We have just moments left, but as you say that, it does make me think about the idea of self-medicating, managing those emotions mm-hmm. as adults, but certainly as young people. And I want to give you a chance to just help us understand maybe if there are other ways that we can help kids so that they don't turn to substances.
Yeah, I tell the story of Georgia in the book, and I'm so proud of her. Georgia is actually her real name. She's an adult, and she felt it was really important to keep her name in there. And she was a daily drinker by the time she was in high school because she was self-medicating for anxiety that wasn't being addressed, and it was just crippling. I drank because of my anxiety. Lots of people take drugs and alcohol because they are trying to not feel things that they don't want to feel. A lot of people take drugs and alcohol because they want to be themselves, but better. They're, you know, the drink that I miss most is the one I can't have now before I go to a dinner party or a party where I have imposter syndrome and I want to get over that hump of the social anxiety. But what I really want for kids is I want them to feel like they are enough, that they have the right to be there, that they are not imposters, that they're good enough just as they are, so that we can help them understand that they don't need to take that first drink or take that first drug in order to feel like they are enough, that they have a place out in the world and they deserve to be there.
Jess, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Leahy is a teacher, a writer, and a mom. She writes about education, parenting, and child welfare. Her new book is called The Addiction Inoculation, Raising Healthy Kids in a Culture of Dependence. It is out today, and you can find more information for that on our website. It is WPR.org. You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You can always keep the conversation going by emailing ideas@WPR.org.